Hey everyone, welcome to Talk Nerdy. I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria, and it is Monday, December 21st. I want to give a shout out to a handful of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week by promoting the show on PayPal and Patreon and on your social media feeds and all of the different ways that you, you know, help support the show. So specifically, I want to thank I'm going to butcher this one. Maria Jose Flores, that might be right, from Kearney, New Jersey. And over on the Patreon portal, I want to thank Elena Scott, Phil T-Bear, a new supporter, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Without you guys, you know, Talk Nerdy wouldn't be possible. And I also want to remind everybody that if you visit the Talk Nerdy store at carasantamaria.com from now until, when did I say? I think December 31st. And you enter the promo code NERDYHOLIDAY, you will get 15% off of your order. And I will also throw in a free goodie from one of my partners. Okay, that's enough business. So let's jump into the show. I am so excited this week to be welcoming one of my fellow SGU podcasters, Evan Bernstein. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Cara. How are you?
This is so fun because usually when I podcast with somebody who's not local to the LA area, I'm either doing it remotely or they're visiting me.
Right.
I'm visiting you.
This is great. I know. In my office.
In your office.
Face to face.
Yeah.
So unusual for us at the SGU. I mean, we're always, or typically, a voice over Skype. We're conferencing in and then each recording ourselves.
Yeah.
And we so rarely get, you know, face-to-face time. So this is really, really a treat.
It's been really fun. I've been here now. Okay, so I'm in Connecticut. It's Sunday that we're recording this. And I flew in on Thursday night. So Thursday was kind of a wash. It was just all travel. Mm. But Friday, we recorded part of our end of year episode at Steve's house in like central command. You
know, that's cool, right. At a hidden bunker.
Yeah, exactly.
Undisclosed location.
And I also spent some time with with Jay and his wife, Courtney, and their adorable kids.
Oh.
And then Saturday, we went to see Star Wars.
We did. Episode 7, The Force Awakens.
Oh, my gosh. So we're not, gonna
we're not going
to give any spoilers,
there, yeah.
But it was really fun, and we all had such a great time. And that's really why I'm here, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Flew out to watch Star Wars and then to podcast about it. But now you and your lovely wife put me up last night in your very comfortable home, which was recently renovated. It's so beautiful.
Well, thank you so much. We're very, very proud of it, and we're very comfortable here. And
yeah.
Jennifer and I both, you know, love having you as a guest, definitely.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's been such a great time. I'm bonding with your dog, Daisy. She's so cute. and now it is just a few hours before, or actually just a couple hours before I have to leave for the airport, but I'm so glad that we have time to sit down and chat.
Likewise.
Yay. And what do we want to talk about? There's so many things to talk about. So far I've had Steve and Jay on the podcast before,
mm-hmm.
But the missing episodes are with you and Bob. It was so interesting when I sat down to talk to Steve and Jay because you get so many things in passing from just meeting up with the same people every week. But we have such a focused, I don't know, mission on SGU.
Right.
It's to be skeptical, to debunk bunk, to right. talk about what's in the news in the science and skeptical world. But we don't often get that personal.
No, it. Look, we have to sort of, you know, set guidelines for ourselves. We can't be an everything podcast, as much fun as those kinds of podcasts are. It's not what we are. It wasn't our mission, you know, when we initially started. And we've kind of just, you know, pretty much stuck to our mission, our core mission. We've done a little expansion here and there. We get into a little tech. We get into a little nerd talk. We, you know, a little cultural,
a little Star Wars,
back and forth. And and occasionally political, especially where it intersects with science and skepticism.
But it's definitely a line in the sand that especially Steve likes to keep very, very firm. I think that he is proud of the fact that his political leanings mm-hmm. are hard to pin down.
Yes,
and
right.
And he keeps them very... you know, very much to himself. When he was on the podcast, I know that we did kind of meander. We didn't get too political, but I was surprised to hear him have very strong opinions about universal health care. Mm-hmm. We were able to get into that, something that I don't think we would often talk about
right
on the show. And also, keep in mind, there's five of us.
That's
if
right.
We were always getting into like personal shit
oh,
on the
gosh.
Show. Like, it's hard enough right now. We record a show. How long is the final airing? Like an hour 20?
80 minutes. That's
80
right.
80 minutes. And we record for 3 hours every day?
Yeah, sometimes as long as 3 hours. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At least 2 hours.
Definitely.
I don't think we've ever taken less than 2 hours.
Yeah, I think 2 hours has been our minimum, but definitely we encroach on 3 hours on a usual recording night.
So he does a lot of work.
He does. He does.
I am too lazy for that. For me, it's like an hour with my guests, maybe an hour and a half if we're going really long. It's so rare that I'll actually edit things out.
And,
only per their request.
And then we never struggle to talk about topics. I mean, it's endless. It really is an ocean that, you know, we're a boat on an ocean as far as information and topics go. There's never nothing to talk about.
That's true. What is your process when you're trying to pick your stories for the week? Because usually what we like to do is, so we record on Wednesday nights for mm-hmm. an episode that goes up on Saturday. And usually either Monday night, probably Steve would prefer it if by Monday night we already had picked our topic. Sometimes
right.
we'll pick them on Tuesdays. What's your process for going through and picking out what you're going to talk about that week?
Well, timing, dates. Mm-hmm. I can't pick something that's too old. Again, we record, like you said, typically on Wednesdays. And by the time Saturday hit, the things we're talking about are already old news.
That's true.
And there have often been developments even on some of these topics. I mean, that's the age of the internet. So I try not to pick things that are too far in the past. I'll mm-hmm. try, which is why we do tend to wait till Monday or Tuesday to pick what it is we're going to talk about.
Yeah, sure. That's why. It's not because I'm lazy at all.
No, it's not. It's not. We try to be, try to be as current as possible. But, as like I said, updates almost daily on these topics, and people have opinions and comments that get thrown into the mix and things that you didn't consider. So it's constantly evolving. It's constantly changing. So you're trying to chase something and grab it at a certain moment. So I try to be sensitive to that. And also, I kind of look for things that certainly interest me and in which I have, certain strengths with. And a lot of those topics have to do with things like reported paranormal activity, reports of faith-based miracles and these sorts of things. I'm not a scientist. I don't. It takes me certainly a lot longer to absorb material that is based, purely on the sciences. Mm-hmm. Not to say that I don't do that. I obviously read those as well. But if I do need to, depending on how much time I have to prep for a topic, I'll tend to go to the paranormal wing of our house, as our skeptical house, as it were.
Yeah.
And I tend to cover those topics probably more often than any other. So I'm concentrating there. And like I said earlier, also, it's endless. You can pick out so many different news items. The choices are wide.
And is that because you have, so you've obviously got a wonderful contextual base because you've been sort of entrenched in that side of the skeptical movement mm-hmm. for so many years now. What kinds of resources do you use? Do you like often read Skeptical Inquirer, Skeptic Magazine? Is that where you find a lot of your information? Or do you just have certain key terms that you like to search for when you do your web searches?
It's more of a key term mm-hmm. search for myself. And I really do read what the paranormalists are saying. And
so
you'd
like
I often
to go to their, so it's not so much reading what the skeptics are saying. You like to go to their website, ghost hunters. And
I do because I do that for a couple reasons. If I go to look for news that has already been reported about a paranormal or pseudoscientific topic, it's out there and there's tons of coverage. There are a lot of people sort of doing the same thing that I'm doing. But if I go to the paranormal sites or the pseudoscience sites first to look for their updates for the day to see what they're doing, they may not necessarily have been picked up on yet. Mm-hmm. So it's an attempt for me to try to not necessarily be first and best at something, but try to bring up a topic in which my audience has not yet been exposed to.
Yeah.
Whereas, come Saturday after a Wednesday recording, they may have already seen a lot of these stories already and I'm then, you know, just kind of piling on it, or in a way at that point. But sometimes it'll be, I'll get emails saying, wow, I didn't hear that. I didn't know that that happened. You know, thanks for bringing that to my attention. So I find those rewarding.
Yeah. And it's always new to me because I'm one of these people who kind of came into the skeptical community, definitely from a science-based perspective, definitely from, I guess, a journalistic perspective. And this, we were just talking about this over breakfast, this world of, like, generally speaking, when I read something about, like, ghost hunters or, like, cryptozoology or religion, like, those kinds of things, I just sort of laugh at. Religion, a little bit different. I do invest a lot of time in, like, kind of the atheist activism side of things, for me personally. But when it comes to what I think of as the traditional, I guess, supernatural side of the skeptical movement, I'm not well-versed at all. If I come across those kinds of things, usually they make me laugh and then I don't read any further.
Yeah.
Obviously, there is a really important place for people to do their due diligence and to do a lot of research and debunk a lot of it, because a lot of people believe in it.
Oh, it's a tremendous amount of people believe in it. And surveys time and time again prove that. And unfortunately, some things trend what we consider to be in the wrong direction. People are becoming less critical about these things, about certain things, as time goes on, which is not good.
Not at all. Did you find yourself first attracted to these topics? Was that your sort of entree into the skeptical movement?
I had, growing up, always loved both science and pseudoscience. So as a boy, I didn't have a problem reconciling to myself that, okay, yeah, all these, you know, astronomy, chemistry, biology, evolution, and these sorts of subjects and topics, I had no problem with them. I didn't see them as a conflict with things like belief in UFOs or certain people, you know, communicating with the dead and other paranormal things. I thought that both had sort of equal, not equal merits, but merits on their own. And why can't you have both? I wasn't able to distinguish between the difference between the two until Steve Novella and Perry DeAngelis, you know, two good friends of mine whom I even knew before our years as skeptical activists, brought to my attention some of the literature which answers a lot of these questions in regard specifically to pseudoscience and paranormal and why it is not science. And at that point, I was 26 years old, so I had already, you know, gone through high school, you know, in college and everything. And I had never been exposed to that way of thinking before until I reached the age of 26, which I'm, you know, I still marvel at that I'm able to get, you know, the kind of education that I had, which was a pretty, you know, not great, but decent enough education. Yet all this stuff just was never taught to me in a formal education setting. I had to leave that sort of system in order to learn really what science was about and really how to detect good science from bad science. So Steve and Perry were my introduction to skepticism, and from there it took off.
So when you were learning science in school, science for you was a topic.
Yes.
It was like, this is the way the world works.
Right.
It wasn't
right.
Like a function, a process, a critical thinking, you know,
no,
exercise.
That's right. That's right. It was a much more compartmentalized thing, something that I didn't necessarily apply it to in like my everyday life or my decision making that I make nowadays. It was just, yeah, okay, these are the facts. This is the way it is. Great. Learn it. Move on.
I think
unfortunately,
that's
an unfortunate failure of many, many of our school systems, you know, not just public school systems. I hear about this in private schools as well.
Yeah. Even as somebody who was trained in the sciences, like for me personally, I don't think until I was in at least undergrad and then even more so in graduate school, did I really start to home in on that side of that aspect of my science education, because up until then it's all foundational, like it's just done backward. It's like, here are all the facts. Once you figure out the facts, then we'll start learning how to learn.
Right. That's right. And you and I have an interest in science, you know, and a real curiosity for it, and we're fascinated by it. So you take the number of people who have gone through the system who have not been exposed to how to think critically in these ways, and they don't have the interest in science, and it's gone. It's kind of out of their life entirely. We're talking tens, hundreds of millions of people, probably in America alone, that are in that category. And that's, that presents a lot of problems for our society.
Definitely. And I think that there are some things that are more obviously kind of in that middle zone that some people sort of believe but don't think about too critically. Like maybe astrology is a good example of that. What's your sign? You know, because they don't really think that deeply into it. Or people who are not really religious, but you still hear them say things like when they lose a loved one, like at least they're watching over you, and you're like,
right.
What?
Right.
Like, wait, where does that come from? But it's, you know, it's like a comfort thing. It's a thing that you've just heard so many times that it's almost regurgitative. I don't think that's a word, but I'm going to make it one. but then you have the other things like literally the Loch Ness Monster and
right.
Bigfoot, where I know that a smaller, it must be a smaller percentage of the population, but there are hardcore believers in it. And these are the things that I usually laugh off and like don't actually endeavor
right.
To think too much about or to do much research. But these things really catch you and they make you interested, right? And
you want
to know about these things.
Yeah.
What are some of the ones that are the most ludicrous to you?
Oh, gosh. Well, the one that is, to me, both the most ludicrous and in my own mind, one of the most dangerous mm-hmm. has to do with exorcisms.
Oh,
the belief that people can, or places or things, are infested with nefarious forces. Call it a demon, call it a devil, call it whatever you want. I mean, mm-hmm. we're talking this sort of biblical translation applied to modern times and modern societies. And I read a disturbingly great number of stories and articles about how many people, many of them children, are abused, injured, or dead now as a result. And this sits so, it really sticks in my craw. I know we talk a lot on the show about alternative medicine and the damage that does to individuals and families, how it absolutely ruins lives to the point of death as well. But in a sense, and I'm not trying to draw an equivalence to that, I kind of get the same emotions stirred up and the same, you know, just, oh gosh, I can't, people are dying about exorcisms and how people really, I mean, tons of people absolutely believe that these sorts of things are possible and happen. And there's the amount of evidence that shows that that's not the case. And what we're dealing with is people who, you know, have real mental conditions and other problems that need to be addressed. It's like this two-sided sword and they're getting both sides of the sword and both sides are really bad.
Yeah.
It bugs me no end. So I try to bring a lot of attention, certainly in my blog posts, and you'll notice kind of a pattern in some of the stories that I bring up on the show that have to deal with that and the real damage. And I think it's an excellent sort of example, unfortunately, as to how medieval kind of thinking can cause medieval sorts of results.
Yeah, I definitely see parallels between the problems that come from exorcism and kind of faith healing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I it's true. We focus a lot of our attention on the pseudoscience of like homeopathy,
right.
And maybe chiropractic and
right, the limitations of chiropractic.
Exactly. Different kinds of like crank, like pseudo medical treatments.
Right.
And
quacks
like
who say they can cure cancer.
And I think maybe there's the reason that we focus so much on that. Well, because it's, you know, Steve is the host of the show and Steve is a physician. And so
board certified neurologist. Yep.
Yeah. He is somebody who's going to be focused on that evidence-based medicine and the things that are in direct opposition to it. But I think that there is sort of a danger to the fact that people like myself often laugh off things that seem too ridiculous. So, you know, exorcism, nobody believes that. No, but people do, right? It's like, mm-hmm. To me, it's so ridiculous that the mainstream, and that's true, the mainstream might not give it a lot of credence, but there's still a huge portion of people who do, but it doesn't get the media coverage that it should, because even with faith healing, for example, when we see a child who dies because they have a certain type of cancer and their parents wouldn't give them medical treatment, they only tried to faith heal them, or they have those weird treatments where they wrap them in hot blankets or
yep.
they'll suffocate them or you
right.
know, put the pillow over their face. And then you see a lot of media attention and people are like, oh my God, I can't believe that this is happening. You don't see that as often with things like exorcism, I think, because it's, to us, so ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas it's so kind of under the radar.
Right. And if you want to take it a step further, mm-hmm. For a lot of people to deny that the devil or demons can inhabit people, places, or things is to, in a certain sense, deny the need for a strong faith in other things, Jesus, God, whatever it is you want to call it. Mm-hmm. You know, you sort of take away one and you feel like you're going to somehow lose or diminish the other.
Yeah, that you're somehow like denigrating the underpinnings of your worldview. Like I can only imagine, my parents are Mormon, right? They're not Catholic. So there are no exorcisms in the Mormon church. This is something you don't often hear about.
Right.
But if faced with a question, you know, I'm sure that my parents, if they read about like a Catholic exorcism, and they would be like, well, that's not real. Maybe that's, you know, that person has schizophrenia, whatever. But I think that if somebody within their ranks, there was media brought to, yeah, but this person, they would have to really start rethinking, for example, their personal, because somewhere mm-hmm. in the Bible, mm-hmm. there's still room for that to be able to happen.
Right.
They think of it as an old school thing that doesn't happen anymore. But if one of the church leaders within the Mormon church all of a sudden said this person had to have an exorcism,
right,
all of a sudden everybody in the Mormon church would be like, yeah, that's legit.
Right.
They would have mm-hmm. to.
That's right. That's
Whereas
right.
It does feel like it's a very specifically Catholic thing, and then like offshoots of Catholicism definitely in like tribal areas, and because you see like the Santeria offshoots and the like what do they call it, that's really heavy in LA, the Church of the Dead. It's like the Santa Muerte.
Oh, you're right.
Like big,
sure.
And
yep,
then you
yep.
also see it in
Spanish culture. Yep.
Yeah.
Influence.
In some African cultures where you have
mm-hmm.
like the witchcraft,
oh, sure.
and the
My
tribal
gosh.
Stuff that's like imbued, right? This way to bring missionary work and say like, I'm not going to make you deny what you already believe. Let's just like incorporate the religion into your own cultural viewpoints. And that's where I think it's much more common in those regions. But you also see it in, I mean, Bobby Jindal did an exorcism in college.
I know. Morgan Freeman's granddaughter mm-hmm. died earlier this year because her boyfriend was trying to exorcise what he thought was a demon out of her and wound up killing her in the process.
Do we know what happened to him?
I don't have the latest on
him. Yeah,
I'm him.
Wondering like where, because obviously
this happened about 2, maybe 3 months ago.
Legally, he should go to prison. You know
what
I mean?
Oh, absolutely.
That's
yes, right.
Murder.
Right.
It's probably not. It's probably manslaughter.
Right.
They can probably argue it down.
They're
going
to try, right, to manipulate it as best as they
Which
can.
Which is so crazy, because there's got to be some sort of like legal argument that the presence of my, which
yeah what's
just
the burden of proof
out.
Here
exactly.
And what is it you're trying, you know, what is it the person is trying to say to defend themselves? Oh, okay, I'm, you know, it was the devil, you know, was in her and did it, and therefore am I really fully responsible for what had to be done? You know, again, it gets into a legal morass about this stuff.
Also, like she was fatally stabbed.
Yes, uh-huh, which is not uncommon.
Traditional exorcism
yeah, well,
technique
yeah,
is to
I know.
Stab somebody. To
I know,
death.
But you'd be surprised at how often you see people, you know, stabbed in the name of exorcism. It's
God,
it's appalling as to the number that's out there. And look, hey, I'm no Google ninja or anything. I don't do anything special. Mm-hmm. You look on the internet for yourself and just, you know, have a look at how many people are dead every day due to exorcism. It is. It's a daily occurrence. So this is what motivates me to try to help people understand about the dangers of pseudoscience and the dangers of the paranormal. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people have fun with it and astrology and stuff, and how much harm is that doing? Yeah, okay, you know, it's maybe limited. You know, I don't know that anyone's necessarily going to die as a direct result of their astrological advice. There probably are some cases, but not nearly, you know,
yeah.
But it does, it's a spectrum of problems
and degrees
and
of freedom away from that. It could contribute, you know, it's funny, like there could be a butterfly effect kind of situation where if you are, or there is, we know this to be the case, if you are more likely to believe in astrology, you may be less likely
sure.
to get the chemotherapy when you're first diagnosed. You may be, you know, all of those things really have correlations together. We see this all the time when we're looking at new studies. It's funny when we get meta on the show and we look
right.
at studies about belief in paranormal or supernatural things, and we do see that there are high correlations between, you know, belief in the supernatural, between belief in religion, between
mm-hmm.
what's conspiracy theory. Like we see a lot of these things that accompany each other. Just so that you know, it took me that long to look it up. But the boyfriend was arrested for, it says here, second degree murder.
Second degree murder.
Of
okay.
course,
yep.
And mm-hmm. is being held.
Okay.
I don't know, you know what, this was in August of this year that was published. I'm sure at this point he hasn't faced trial yet.
No, I don't think so. Yeah, it'll be next summer probably before we see what the results of that is.
It's so crazy.
It is crazy. What a world. I tell you. So we're just trying to do our part to help people understand. And I think, look, for me growing up until I'm 26, I don't know the difference between science and pseudoscience, but after that, I finally do understand how best to distinguish the two. And that's helped me a lot understand about so many other things and how to really think critically about a whole host of things, not just having to do with science, but also, you know, practical, economical, political. Skepticism is a great utility. It really should be applied to just about anything. I don't think you can ever go wrong applying skepticism to anything you want.
And it's a lifelong journey. That's a great thing about it, too. Just like with science, it's, you know, you could say maybe that you or Steve or somebody who's like, or James Randi is like it, right? Like, oh, he's a skeptic. He knows the difference. But I'm sure even in your daily, there's always something nuanced. There's always something that you approach where you're like, this isn't as clear cut as I was hoping it would be. I need to read more about this. And I think that that's such a wonderful thing that continue to learn. It's interesting that you mentioned a skeptical approach to politics, because that's something that we don't often talk about on the show. I think because it can be polarizing. It's definitely an editorial decision that Steve made early on. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you may be able to guess some of our political leanings sometimes
maybe
on the show. But
sometimes people are way off.
Yeah, definitely. I think that people will guess. It's so funny. People who don't know me well, who maybe don't listen to Talk Nerdy, but they'll hear me and other things, will think that I'm a super conservative when they hear me talk about GMOs or vaccines. And then they'll hear me talk about like LGBT rights or something. They're like, oh, she's such a lefty.
Right.
And it's hard to pin down, which is why I like to say I'm independent, right? Like, I'm definitely left-leaning. For sure, I'm left-leaning, but I'm not a Democrat. Like, to me, there's no difference, really, between the Democrats and the Republicans. They're very similar. Steve says all the time that people really can't peg him, which is very funny to me. But it's been made clear to me that in some ways you're kind of the token conservative on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm not ashamed to talk about it. And anytime anyone asks me, I'll talk to them quite frankly about that. And I'm conservative in some things.
Yeah.
In some things. I have these more, you know, traditional opinions. I have certain opinions when it comes to how we interpret our Constitution.
Sure.
And
like economically, I'm assuming that you probably have some more
economically. I certainly do. I'm a fan of Milton Friedman, whose works I've read and videos I've watched online. That's Milton Friedman for all you YouTubers out there. Nice little 2 and 3 minute chunks, and you can get in a few minutes. You can kind of really get to know what the conservative philosophy about economics really is.
What about, how do you feel about, so it's one thing to say conservative and liberal, which I say a lot, or conservative and progressive.
It's not a fair to kind of bottle these things into this or that.
It's hard too, because I think when we think about the traditional two-party system in this country, and we say Democrats and Republicans, sometimes we'll say, okay, well, I'm more conservative, generally I'll vote more Republican, or I'm more liberal, generally I'll vote more Democratic. Like, yes, I am not going to vote for Donald Trump. Like, I am obviously going to vote for probably whoever wins the Democratic primary, because that is the way I'm leaning right now, and I don't see anybody farther left than that. That I could, you know, I definitely had some Naderisms in the past and would vote
some
in that way.
With that,
but it must be tough as somebody who maybe considers themselves more libertarian leaning to see, for example, a conservative candidate who maybe you so agree with on economic issues and on some more traditional issues, who is very third rail socially.
Right.
You know, like, I wonder how you, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I wonder how do you reconcile, if you are more conservative leaning, if you hear a candidate who's supposed to be representative of you say something like maybe hateful about a certain group of people.
Sure. Look, candidates are people. They're you, they're me, they're our neighbors. These are not people that deserve to be put up on certain pedestals that they do or be lauded about the way they are. I know they're trying to achieve something, run for a job. It's kind of part of it's part of the deal when you run for an office, that sort of inflation effect in an individual happens, but we have to remember that we are, you know, we these are all people,
yeah,
and we are all equal and need to be sort of treated the same. The same rules sort of need to apply to us all. I'm not sure I'm necessarily answering your question here, but what I'm trying to do is say that you should take your skeptical principles or critical thinking abilities and apply them as best as you can to the candidates that you agree with the most.
Okay.
And I think when people do that, first of all, they have a hard time doing that because there's a lot of other things weighing in. There's a lot of emotion. There's a lot of, you know, just what you feel in your gut, what you feel in your heart
and
about a candidate,
cows.
Sacred cows,
you know,
all these things
that,
are playing against it. So it's not as easy a thing to do is to really do a critical analysis of the candidates that you tend to agree with the most. And I think you'll find some surprising things when you start doing some deep digs into some of these things that people have said. And like you alluded to earlier, there is no perfect candidate. That is a myth. There is no one person out there who can ever represent everything and embody everything that you would like. So what you're really doing is trying to make the best out of what are typically not great choices as far as I'm concerned in flawed candidates. But hey, these are people, these are human beings, and you sort of have to remember that. And I think it's a more even-handed approach, I think, at evaluating candidates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And trying to figure out exactly
where
they stand on things.
To use those skeptical viewpoints. And, you know, it's funny. We often focus on the executive branch, which is kind of like inconsequential in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
We often don't focus on our legislators, mm-hmm. which, you know, I always talk about having I think evidence-based politics is really, really important, but it's less about evidence-based politics, because politics really is a specific type of game. It's a specific type of race
right. That's
always happening. It's more about evidence-based legislation, which we don't often talk about on the show, and I would love to see us talk about that on the show more, because that is politically divorced.
Right.
Legislation is, whether you're a Democrat or Republican or whatever, if a law is passed, mm-hmm. it becomes the law of the land, mm-hmm. this is something that all people have to abide by, regardless of your political leaning. Mm. And we can be making decisions based on the laws that are written and drafted and actually enacted that are based on evidence. And we just don't do it much in this country.
Right, right. And I tend to lean a little more libertarian, I think, in this direction, mm-hmm. in that we're not as good with our civic duties as being responsible voters.
Oh, yeah.
As we are. We tend to be kind of lazy about things, and it's hard. There's so much information to absorb, and how nuanced can you get, and how much time really can a person devote into, you know, reading up on this stuff really on a daily basis is really what it takes. It takes a lot of effort. Now, I've always been a political animal pretty much all my life. Since I was 10 years old, I've been kind of into politics and following it and listening to talk radio shows about politics as I was growing up, which is kind of what, you know, sparked an interest in podcasting and broadcasting for me.
Yeah.
So it's always been a part of me. And these are kind of my observations over the years and where I've kind of wound up at this stage of my life. We need to, legislation is, you know, you're right, the ultimate thing that we do should be really concentrating on more. And I think so much stuff gets passed that absolutely has no business getting passed. And this is where I say I'm a little bit more libertarian leaning, is I take more of the Jeffersonian approach that the government that governs least governs best. And I think there's just way too much, bills that get passed with, you know, pork and incentives
and
big kickbacks.
Bipartisan,
and,
or I could say nonpartisan.
Oh, gosh,
like
it's the political landscape.
The
it is. It is. This is nothing new either. It's been happening for hundreds of years.
Yeah, it has absolutely nothing to do with how conservative or how progressive you are. It is. I wonder how heavily we would agree. I am a strong advocate of taking money out of politics.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a strong advocate of campaign finance reform. And I think that campaign finance reform really is the underpinning of major change. And I call it progressive change, only in the sense of that it's moving us forward and away from an antiquated system that's been very damaging to us as individuals. And I'm wondering if you or if other conservatives that you talk to about politics are on the same bent about that.
We should be on. We should be. There's a lot of conservatives will bring up the fact that that's a violation of First Amendment rights. Hmm. And that is, of course, what the Supreme Court has decided, which is why corporations and large donations are allowed to still be made these days. And yes, it does, without question, it influences politics. How can it not?
Yeah.
These baskets of money, which is why the Trump phenomenon, I think, is really a fascinating thing. We're now, here's someone who is absolutely, and look, I'm not by no means endorsing this man, but here's somebody who plays by other rules.
Yeah.
He's coming in, he's not accepting, as far as we know, money from anybody, and he's just totally self-financing himself. This is kind of what happened 25 years ago with Ross Perot, and mm-hmm. there have been other examples
but
of
Ross
this sort
Perot
of stuff.
Definitely did not have the leverage that Trump has. I mean, Ross Perot definitely captured the public imagination, but Trump is leaps and bounds ahead in the primary race so far.
He's a marketing genius, is what he is. The man has spent to date $250,000 on advertising out of his pocket. $250,000. That is what he spent. Think about that, folks. He has gotten more attention than any candidate at this stage of primaries in the history of politics.
Yeah.
The coverage that Donald Trump has right now is just skyrocketing off the chart.
And
he has spent, it is all free. He is a genius when it comes to this sort of stuff. He is playing the game, and he's winning in this respect.
And it's
right
one of those
now.
Things
and
where
he knows it, and he absolutely knows it. And the political class and the journalism class of society and the media class, they don't know how to deal with it, how to handle it. They can't control it. There's nothing they can do about it, and it's driving so many people in so many different corners of this entire political spectrum nuts, mm-hmm. that he's absolutely bucking these trends. And I in a way sort of admire that, and I'm really enjoying, if I can say that, seeing how this is all playing out, because it's not anything we've really experienced before.
It really isn't. It's one of those things where it's frustrating to sit back, because you can approach things, you can attempt to approach things. I think I need to say that word. This is an operative
yeah.
word here. You can attempt to approach things from a purely kind of cognitive perspective and be like, oh, this is fascinating. And this is, you know, and I want to calculate it and understand it. But the minute that you start to, and how do you not, bring in any sort of moral or ethical angle to the question, then you start to feel really conflicted,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I would assume you would agree. Again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but he has said things and done things that I think really are fundamentally immoral.
Sure. I have no problem with that, with somebody believing that.
Wondered, this has always been a struggle for me, right?
But are we looking for morality through our politics and politicians? I think that's also a bigger question. And
exactly.
is that really where we should be going for these sorts of things? And if you ask me, I say no.
And I had a similar viewpoint. I remember when I was in college, I wrote a paper about seatbelt legislation, and I had a very kind of libertarian viewpoint when I wrote this paper. And I look back and I read it, and it's like, fundamentally, unwaveringly, we should not be legislating morality. Morality
right.
has no business in our legislation, and we should only be looking at the facts. And I'm not sure I feel that way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny. I think that my position in that view has really changed a lot. And I'm wondering if it's almost a full 180, where basically legislation has everything to do with
mm-hmm.
fairness and the rights of individuals, and it's almost impossible to divorce morality from things like civil liberties.
Right.
And it's an interesting paradox, being somebody who works as a skeptical advocate and a skeptical activist, that you often try to take your emotions out of the decisions that you make and look at things in a very purely evidence-based way.
We try.
You try.
We often fail.
And you do often fail. And sometimes I wonder if those failures are really a bad thing, because you definitely see historical examples where I think eugenics is such a good example. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to ignore the eugenics movement, both in this country and obviously in Germany and in, you know, other areas of the world. It's a plot point on the Nick right now, and it's a fascinating plot point. I'm loving this show. And it's a fascinating plot point because you see these medical doctors, these men of science, who, because of the way that we do science and because it is human beings that do science, could very readily point to evidence that says a certain sect of this country is cognitively less developed, is what it, because the tests at the time were biased, because the amount, like when you have a certain portion of the population that is economically disenfranchised and that is educationally disenfranchised, and then you try and test intellect or you try and test somebody's ability to what would I say? I dropped my mic there. Somebody's ability to make money, somebody, you know, whatever it is, the way that you're testing it, when the playing field isn't leveled, the evidence actually comes in that those people are somehow less than. And then that provides, I think, a platform for individuals. And of course, eugenics is the most extreme example to say, well, if these people are less than scientifically, should they vote the same way? If they're less than scientifically, should they breed the same way? And you start to see all of these just morally bankrupt, just disgusting, where people are using science as I guess, justification. And oftentimes, I feel like this can be a dangerous outcome of attempting to remove morality from a scientific endeavor.
Boy, those are big thoughts. I'm not really sure how to compound that or sort of echo that. I have thought about similar things in the past. It's not, you know, life is not full of straight lines. There are twists and turns and bends and contradictions, and you often wind up, you know, contradicting yourself at certain times when you're analyzing things and having to rethink and think things again, and you never stop thinking about these things. Gosh, it's so fuzzy. It is the grayscale of grayscales, as far as I'm concerned. I don't know what the right answer is there. I don't know that there is a right answer there. I do know that when we start looking for our answers to many of our problems, and we turn to our politicians or our political parties or other apparatus such as that for answers and solutions, I find that we are more often disappointed than not. And that's
true. The people that we think of as our leaders, the people that we actually elected to represent us, often don't represent us.
Maybe I'll liken it to our judicial system. We have a judicial system in this country. It's different than judicial systems other places. What judicial system is the best system? There is no flawless judicial system. We're doing kind of the best that we feel that we can, and it's this innately flawed thing that we can never really get a hold of or control. Thing we talk about a lot on the Skeptic's Guide is the illusion of control, the illusion of order, where chaos actually reigns. And perhaps in the sense of science and our politics, this might be one of those areas as well.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those. You know, there are some skeptics who in the movement focus on morality and focus on ethics and how do ethics come to play in the skeptical movement. And to me, that's a really fascinating angle, because it's one that we often conveniently ignore, because it's just a little easier. Everything's a little cleaner when you don't bring the feels into it.
That's right. Yeah, well, yeah.
It's like, oh, the best skeptics don't feel anything. They just think, right? It's like an easy way to kind of try and approach the problem.
Yeah, but we're humans, so that kind of, you know, like everybody else. And
it's impossible.
It's impossible. And actually, it's a good reminder of, well, we're constantly reminding ourselves of our flaws. I mean, that's sort of what skepticism and critical thinking is these innate biases we have towards so many things in our life. I mean, we're biased on, you know, you name it. We have biases towards it. And to practice good skepticism, you have to constantly remind yourself, constantly fight against these biases, and constantly keep in your scope of thinking that you are being influenced by so many things that have happened in your past, that are currently happening, that people around you are influencing you, your job is influencing you, what the TV is telling you, what the radio is telling you. and trying to make sense of this, but look, with our flawed brains the way they are, it's no wonder all these problems sort of arise, and yeah. we ultimately make bad decisions. We just try to minimize the amount of bad decisions that we will wind up making.
Yeah, and it's like, you know, everything can't be premeditated. So sometimes you, even when you make bad decisions, you try to kind of flex your skeptical muscle a little bit and learn from those decisions and learn from those mistakes and say, is that a decision that I made appropriately? Is mm-hmm. that a decision that I can, I don't know, change after the fact? Is it something I can reverse? Is yeah. it something that I can at least use to my advantage? Because also, that is how you learn. It is absolutely impossible to learn if you don't make just horrific mistakes.
Oh, gosh,
throughout
your
yes, life.
You
just
have
like
to.
Blatant errors.
You have to. What did I read recently? Was it a book? No, an article online. And darn it, I'm sorry I don't have it at my reference. I would love to be able to give it to share with other people. It was a great article about how it's important for, when you're kids, when, you know, we think we protect our children. We don't ever want any harm to come of our children. We never want our children to be sick. We never want our children to experience pain or discomfort or anything. And they're arguing, and I think correctly so, is that, no, you do have to expose them to certain limited risks early in life. For example, give your seven-year-old a Swiss Army knife to play with. Are they going to cut themselves? Well, yeah, possibly, you know. I mean, yeah. they might damage themselves a little bit, but they're also going to learn maybe some valuable lessons from that, or some things that they'll be able to carry forward from those moments that they won't have to, you know, deal about when they're, you know, teenagers and not equipped to sort of deal with things. And I thought that was interesting and a good little reminder about how it's important to expose ourselves to certain things and fall down and fail.
Yeah.
Dust yourself, get back up again, try again, go again. We're forgiving, you know, humans are tend to be forgiving about a lot of things, and we're often our own harshest critics. Mm-hmm. So kind of remember that. And it's important, like you were saying.
I think it's interesting too, because we think about this, like how there's a clear distinction between childhood and adulthood. And I think for legal purposes, we have to do that. We have to say at the age of 18, you can consent to joining the army and smoking
right.
cigarettes and having sex. And prior to that, you can't consent. I
yeah.
think it's a huge movement. I'm working on a story right now for the local news show I do about trafficking, human trafficking,
yeah.
modern slavery, sex trafficking. And you know, you think about like women in shipping containers, and you know, you have these ideas in your head of what sex trafficking is. And what we're really focusing is on local sex trafficking. You know, we're focusing on basically what used to be called a prostitute.
Right.
The cops used to pick up a girl who's 15 on the street selling her body for sex and arrest her
right.
and call her a prostitute. And now they're starting to rethink and say, wait, no, you're a victim. Like
right.
nobody under 18 chooses to do this. This is modern slavery. Mm-hmm. Somebody has basically figured out how to own you and mm-hmm. figured out how to make money off of you. And we do have these somewhat arbitrary lines in the sand. And we know from, you know, our understanding of neuroscience that certain parts of the brain are still developing. But what you were talking about the Swiss Army knife, I think it's such an interesting thought experiment, right? Because mm-hmm. give your seven-year-old a Swiss Army knife. Don't give your seven-year-old a shotgun.
Right.
You know
yes.
what I mean? Like
limitations.
Are,
I said limited risk.
And then the interesting thing is that once you're 18, all of a sudden the safety net falls away.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And there's this expectation that now as early as 18 or as late as 18, depending on the way that you look at it, that parental guidance, who for many people, unfortunately, was never there, is no longer this cushy safety net. And all of a sudden, all of those things that we learned between those in those very sensitive and critical periods of development have to carry us for the rest of our lives, when unfortunately it's just not that clean cut. We're
mm-hmm.
continuing to make mistakes. Those mistakes have much heavier consequences the older we get.
Yes.
And so in some ways, I would say that really supports this idea. Fuck up early.
Yes.
Because if you're fucking up early, it's less consequential.
I agree.
You know what I mean?
Like, imagine if you didn't have a cold till you were 8.
Oh my
what
God.
Would that be like?
Or like, I think
be
I read
in such
an
misery.
Article recently about a woman who had never felt pain.
Yo, the people who can't feel
pain.
Oh, I feel so horrible for those
but
people.
But yeah, because usually they die young because they have some sort of like injury and they're bleeding internally. And
they'll
they don't
break a bone and not know
they
it.
Don't know
I mean,
broken. It's crazy. But this article, again, like I really apologize for not being able to reference anything. This is what happens when you talk off the cuff. But this article about this woman, it's like she felt pain for the first time because of some
right.
sort of treatment.
Mm-hmm.
How weird.
Very
but
weird.
How you think of it like, oh, that'd be crippling, and it's probably a lifesaver for her, an absolute lifesaver. What are, so how are we on
time? I'm sorry. Yeah, I was going to write it down for you. No, it's 49 minutes.
49 minutes. That's so great. Okay, cool. So we're doing awesome.
Okay.
We're going to be wrapped up soon. I always close the podcast with the same two questions. I'm not going to do it quite yet. I'm going to save a couple of minutes before we do. But what else have I always wanted to ask Evan Bernstein that I haven't been able to? Is it Bernstein or Bernstein?
Bernstein.
Bernstein. That's what I thought. That's what I thought.
But I'll reply to both.
What about Yvonne?
Even no, it's more even. People will call me even.
No, people call me even.
They'll call me even. They will spell even, E-V-E-N, to me in emails. It is the most common sort of mistake of my name.
Seriously?
It's just,
wow.
And I don't know. I grew up in a time in which there weren't many Evans out there. Yeah, I had come across maybe one or two others in my first 15 years of life. So it was a real rare thing for me. I think people heard the name and never heard it before, never had to comprehend it before. It's closest to the word even, which is, in their everyday language. So that's it. It's just an easy substitute for people who are unfamiliar with me. Not at all.
Really? When people call me Cara, it drives me crazy.
Oh, okay.
I don't know why. And when people spell my name with a K, it drives me crazy. I get it. People do it all the time. I always give people who are like British and Australian a pass. It's just really hard to pronounce Cara if you're British or Australian.
There's a person I'm very fond of in the skeptical and world of astronomy. I won't mention names here. I'll let you figure out if you know who I'm speaking about. But don't call her name by the shorter version of her name.
She'll lose her mind.
It's not that. It's not that. She will correct you immediately before moving on to the conversation and make sure that you understand that that's the way it is.
It's funny.
Which is fine. And when it happened to me, because it happened to me, I was taken aback for maybe a quarter of a second and then realized, okay, it's cool. It's cool. But it was just that quick moment of like punch. Whoa. Okay. I did something really bad there and I didn't know. Oh God. Names can be, I don't want to say a sensitive thing
they
to
can,
people,
though,
but
like a sticking point for people. I never correct anybody. I answer to Cara all the time, but in my heart of hearts, I'm like fuming when I do it.
I just call you CSM.
CSM. I love.
Yeah.
Everyone
CSM.
Calls me CSM. It's so fun. But also another thing that drives me crazy is when people call me Cara S.
It's
SM.
Right.
My last name is two words, but I think it's just when you look at your credit statement, like your credit report, or you look at your social security, like the FBI kind of, or like background checks, and you're like, I have 1,200 pseudonyms, none of which I've ever personally.
Wow.
Because, so not 1,200, but when you've been getting mail your entire life to Maria C. Santa.
Yes, right.
Cara Louise Maria. And you're like, who are these humans? And then somehow that gets in your like background and you're like,
yeah,
I
sure
didn't
does.
Do that,
yeah,
you
sure
assholes,
does.
Because you made a typo when you were inputting my name.
Between the human error and the computer not caring, it's a morass.
And even when I was in Texas, for example, all of my driver's licenses are, my last name's hyphenated because it was incomprehensible to their system.
Right.
You couldn't put in a
that's right. Yeah,
name.
The computer can't justify it. So it will do something that will justify it. That happens at the IRS too. You put in a street address in one of their forms or something, if you're doing something with the IRS website, I'm familiar with this because I'm an accountant, so I deal with the IRS, and you put it in, you put a street in, the next field that comes up is, oh, did you mean this? And this is how it is in our system, therefore this is how it's going to be in your system, buddy. You don't have a choice.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. It's just a street, abbreviation.
Yeah,
or something,
it's like, I want to write
no
the whole word
deal.
Street and not ST.
But
no,
it happens
whatever.
Every single time you go in there and do it. That's just kind of an example.
It's
of
so
that.
Funny. People think my middle name is Santa.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, what?
Santa.
Santa. My parents actually named me Cara Maria with a middle name Santa.
Good thing your last name wasn't Claus.
I know. Or all my friends used to call me Cara Nita Pita Santa Maria.
Right, of course, because that's very
funny. It's hilarious.
Yes, I know. That was all the rage on the playground in kindergarten.
But it is funny. It's funny because there are very few things, I think, in life that we consider these sort of salient, definitive things. Our name is one of them.
Mm-hmm.
Our sense of identity comes from our name, from the way that we dress, from our family members, and sometimes you reject certain things.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some people who change their names, but there's so many people who really, that's a whole sense of self is the way you're labeled.
Look, I understand for yourself and actually for this other person who I brought up, you guys are media figures.
Yeah.
So that is kind of important. It is a tag. It is your name tag, and it does have to be correct. Myself, I'm not nearly that exposed. I mean, a little bit, but not to the point where, you know, it does require it to be accurate. You know, so what? Even Bernstein. But you know, but look, for your body of work that you've done, your exposure and everything you're doing, I think it is more important for some people than others.
But what about, you know what? Last thing, I think, before we get to the final two questions, what about that? Being a member of the SGU, I was talking to Jay about this a little bit in the car because he and his wife were, I was staying with them for the first couple of days and they drove me to the movie and we just had a lot of time to chat. And we were talking about this idea of like fame or what is a concept of fame,
mm-hmm.
and being famous within certain niche communities.
It's a bubble. How big is your bubble?
And the truth of the matter is probably before SGU, that bubble was much smaller.
Oh, okay.
And now that you are, or all of you, are it's been 10
mm-hmm.
years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe it's 6 months. Like, it's going to take a while before. People still don't recognize. It's so funny. Like, when we went to this, when we went to Star Wars, there were fans, but there were also friends and, you know, a lot of great people
family.
And there were people who were like, this one guy, I can't remember who it was, but I think it was a friend of the show, and he shook my hand and introduced himself. Oh, hi, I'm Kara, blah, blah, blah. And I was standing next to Jay. So how do you guys know each other? And Jay
right.
was like, she's Kara. She's the new Rogue, blah, blah, blah. And he was like, oh! It was this, like, hilarious recognition.
Couldn't make, right, did not make the connection.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Because, yeah, I'm new and it's going to take a while. But you've been doing this now for 10 fucking years.
Yeah, 10 years.
And so when you go to especially specific types of conferences, when you're at Nexus, when you're at TAM, when you're in certain arenas,
mm-hmm.
you're like it. Like, you have a crowd of people around you. Everybody wants to shake your hand, get your signature, get your autograph, talk to you.
That's the bubble.
Talk your ear off about. What was that like for you when it first started and you started to like, did you hate it? Did you kind of love it?
No, I liked it.
Yeah.
No, it was cool. A lot of people wanted, you know, just hang and talk and get to know you a little bit better. I've never pretended to be something I'm not. Mm-hmm. So people, and I think that's the one of the magical things about the podcast is that we are really ourselves on the show. We're not trying to put on any airs or pretend to be something we're not. And people want to really genuinely kind of get to know you. And know a little bit more about you and feel a little bit more of a personal connection to you. And I totally, first of all, understand that because I've obviously been there with other people who I've, you know, very much look up to or admire very much for their work that they've done in their life. And so I adapted to it, I think, you know, pretty well. And again, I also understand it is a bubble. It's finite. It's contained. Yes, in some circles, I'm considered, what if you want to call it a celebrity or a star or mm-hmm. a character figure, whatever you want to call it. Great. Outside that bubble, I'm, Joe Smith.
Yeah.
Right. No, you know, and nobody. And that's fine, too. You know, it has big advantages, certainly to that as well. No, but it's
definitely a fine line on both sides of that bubble.
Yeah.
Like, you're too famous, your life sucks.
Right. Yeah,
you
know, I know.
Totally.
Yeah, people,
like,
people caring a little bit too much about the other things that you're doing with your life.
Do you ever find it a little overwhelming?
No, it hasn't gotten to the point of being overwhelming. Struck a pretty good balance between a lot of things in my life. I do consider this I don't want to call it a job because I don't want to make it seem mundane. I mean, frankly, this is our hobby. This is our leisure time. This is what we love to do when we're not doing our regular, because we all have other jobs.
Yeah.
That we report to, and it is a lot of work. We do take it seriously. We have tremendous fun with it. At the same time, we love doing it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it nor doing it for so long. And it's yielding results, and that's always that feedback that you get when you get emails from people who are saying what a positive impact you're having in their life. Boy, that's the best. That's the absolute best
part
about this.
The best part.
Absolutely.
Those email, being on those email chains, as soon as I signed up, you know, or joined up with you guys. And so all the emails that people send in, we see them all.
Oh,
we,
yes.
You know, not all of them. There's a couple that are secure from us, like science or fiction. We don't get to see, like only Steve sees those.
Right.
But,
yeah.
But most all of the emails, we get to read them all. And definitely when I first joined you guys 6 months ago, most of them didn't apply to me, and slowly but surely I've you know, integrated and become a part of the team.
Yeah.
And sometimes my name is mentioned in them, but regardless, being part of SGU and as it continues to grow, that positive feedback of hearing how people's lives have been dramatically changed,
mm-hmm.
and improved,
mm-hmm.
and just the warmth that we get from the listeners is like literally the reason to do it.
Oh, absolutely.
It's everything.
I think so. Yeah. It turns out being this. These are the dividends.
Yeah.
These are the dividends for all the investment of time and effort that we are making. And I think we earn more in the dividends than we do in the investment itself. And as long as that ratio continues, this will never end. And we will continue to do it. And we will continue to help people and, you know, help spread the word. And fortunately, we were one of the first ones out there, mm-hmm. doing it. We kind of hit it at the sweet spot at the right time in 2005 when it was all starting to come around. Web 2.0 was starting to blossom. And we fortunately were able to realize that we had something here which people could definitely relate to and would be interested in. And 63 million downloads later, here we are today,
yeah.
10 and a half years later, talking about it. And, you know, gosh, I don't know. How else I can express how great it is, how great it's been.
What a wonderful note.
Yeah.
To roll to the close of the show on. You know, every week I finish the show by asking my guests the same two questions.
Okay.
Always starting with the one which will likely have a really bummer answer, and then finishing with the uplifting one.
Okay.
Very big, very broad.
Okay.
Don't hate me.
I don't hate you.
So the first
Not yet.
question is that when you think to the future,
mm-hmm.
in whatever context you like, whether it's personal or global or, you know, small picture, big picture, whatever, I want to know what the thing is that you're most concerned about. What is the thing that keeps you up most at night? The thing that really worries you the most about the future? And then on the flip side of that,
mm-hmm.
what are you most optimistic about, most looking forward to and excited about?
Okay, so the thing I probably worry about the most, again, I alluded to earlier in the show, is that when we're speaking about politics and things, and I do worry about the state and stability of our society. And I'm not one of these people who is a conspiracy theorist, nor am I ringing alarm bells in any sense, but I do have a pretty decent sense of history and how history, you know, we think that certain things are forever in our past,
mm-hmm.
That can never happen again, and that we have hopefully as a species and culture and country and planet learned certain things, but that's wishful thinking, I think, to a degree, because human beings will still continue to be human beings, and they will still continue to have wars, and societies will collapse and crumble, and it's not a matter of if, as far as I'm concerned, it's only a matter of when. And the more we lose perspective on these sorts of things, and we start looking more at these short-term chunks of time and history and how we choose to make decisions and analyze these things, we lose sight of the long-term fact that these things are fleeting and temporary. And I know I'm kind of being a little bit broad in that, and I'll, I guess, let you interpret maybe a little bit about where, how I feel that will play out in society, because I don't exactly know.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as civil wars and holocausts and other things have happened in the past, I fear that they can happen again. And when we lose recognition of that and we forget that these things have happened, that's when they're most likely to happen before we know it.
Yeah, I agree. I heavily agree.
And optimism?
Yeah, yeah. Let's end on a good note.
let's end on a very good note.
I'm crying, Evan.
optimism. Look, the internet has changed the world.
Yeah.
Like I said the other day, there have been two inventions that have shaped society and mankind. Fire and then the internet. So maybe
that's a stupid wheel.
Gosh, that what did that really do anything for us? No, I'm joking, of course, you know, half-heartedly joking, but the importance of the internet, web community,
yeah.
how it's connected the planet, in a way that has never been there before. The repository of information and data, shared knowledge that happens, I think, in all of our problems, we can find solutions by this sort of technological advancements that we have made, and not be afraid of them and sort of embrace them and start to use these tools for better purposes, which we are already seeing happen in so many different ways. And we didn't talk about global warming specifically or anything like that, and you know, I'm not one of these people who denies that it's happening. It obviously is happening, and we are the cause of it. Make that clear. I also strongly believe that it will be science and technology that will ultimately come up with the correct solutions on how to deal with the problem. And I have a lot of optimism that one problem, plus a lot of other problems, you know, world hunger and these other things, science will, so long as we don't destroy ourselves before then, will eventually make a lot of these things better.
Yeah, I really do think that it's a function of when, not if.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. The fear is that the when comes sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
Because I definitely agree that we are well on our way to devising real solutions. The question is, will we have the political will enforce those solutions?
Yep. And it all ties in. And unfortunately, my feelings on that matter are in the negative side right now. I think we are we're not going about it correctly, and there's too many inherent problems there right now.
We're definitely stuck.
We are stuck, and
science has not science has not been celebrated the way that I think we need a renaissance of even what we saw in the 60s in this country, which was a celebration of science that I never even got to experience.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I know.
Like, I was so excited about the 60s when I wasn't alive.
Right. Right. No, absolutely. You know, the moon mission and everything else that was certainly going on in that time. You're right. We need these now. We don't need them at the cost of great wars and these sorts of things in order to finally ultimately get there. Like, we don't want to have a war in order to come up with the tools and things we need to ultimately solve these problems. Let's hope there are more peaceful ways of accomplishing these things.
But wouldn't it be wonderful if our conflict with ISIS was revolving around who could get to the moon first?
Gosh.
Right?
Gosh.
I mean, definitely a different time and a different type of skirmish and conflict.
That's right. And boy, let's
end on a happy note.
Yeah, happier note.
Yay, skepticism
and science. Science delivers the goods, as Carl Sagan once said.
Definitely, and also billions and billions, which he never said.
He
also
never said that.
Luke, I am your father. It was actually no, I am your father.
I was
very disappointed.
Oh, and Han didn't shoot first. He shot. He was the only one.
He was the only one who shot. Exactly.
There's another misnomer. Greedo. We're correcting all sorts of things today.
Well, thank you so much, Evan, for first of all, for welcoming me into your home for this wonderful weekend, for podcasting with me, letting me use your equipment even, because I forgot to bring a certain cable.
God, that's easy. Easy peasy.
So much fun, and I know that my listeners learned so much, and I'm sure that they were just chomping at the bit to hear from you. It's been a blast.
Oh, it's been great, Kara. Thank you so much.
Of course. And everybody listening, I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk to you.